This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Can It Happen Here? Authoritarianism in America by Cass R. Sunstein. Read by Kaleo Griffith. Introduction. Cass R. Sunstein. The United States is living under a military dictatorship. No one dares to call it that. But that's what it is. Here's what happened. A year ago, a terrorist organization launched a successful attack in Chicago. 2,000 people were killed. President Donald Trump declared a national emergency and imposed martial law. With overwhelming popular support, he ramped up existing surveillance policies. The government is now monitoring all emails and telephone calls. Americans know that they are being monitored. Most of them don't mind. In President Trump's words, privacy just isn't smart. Harkening back to the late 1800s, the Trump administration made sedition a crime. Sedition includes disloyalty to the United States, which includes actions that demonstrate sympathy to our nation's enemies. Under the sedition laws, thousands of people have been arrested. No one knows exactly how many. Muslim Americans must register with the authorities. And if they engage in suspicious behavior, the authorities will pay them a visit. Preventative detention has become routine. No one knows how many people have been detained. There is a lot of private violence against people who are thought to be disloyal. As a precautionary measure, tens of millions of people are displaying American flags on their automobiles and homes. It's not easy to leave the country. If you do, beware. It's tough to get back in. If you aren't an American citizen, good luck. Since the Chicago attack, Congress has capitulated to the president's demands and enacted the laws he favors. The federal judiciary has upheld his programs. So far, the press remains free, at least as a formal matter. But the most popular news outlets enthusiastically embrace President Trump's programs. They're careful not to criticize him. The majority of Americans dismiss the president's critics as sources of fake news. The Department of Justice is starting to investigate some sources of fake news for possible sedition. Whether or not the investigations result in prosecution, the dissenting news outlets are increasingly marginal. In terms of impact, they're failing, and their economic situation is increasingly dire. In a recent speech to a joint session of Congress, President Trump declared that the war on Islamic terrorism had no beginning and has no end. Sure, I made all that up and it's just a story. It's hardly likely. Some of the chapters here will defend that view. But if you find anything in the narrative even close to imaginable, we could try a few others. North Korea attacked Guam and the president claimed emergency powers. China did something frightening and horrific. And the president claimed, we are now at war. The economy took a horrific downturn, and the president contended that he must do whatever needs to be done to protect the country. Better yet, a catastrophe or a threat took a form that we cannot even imagine, producing something like the situation just described. Fiction writers like Sinclair Lewis, Philip K. Dick, and Philip Roth have ventured alternative histories of the United States, in which some kind of authoritarianism ends up triumphant. Maybe Germany won World War II. Maybe the United States fell under the spell of an authoritarian ruler. If you like alternative history, and I confess that I love it, it's probably for one of two reasons. First, a tale of what might have been can tell us something important and even profound about ourselves. It seizes on some feature of our national character. Small or large, hidden or overt, or some inclination that some people have. And it shows what might have happened if that feature or tendency had somehow flowered. Roth's book, The Plot Against America, is a masterpiece in that vein. What might have been's warn us. Inside every human heart, there's a fascist waiting to come out. George Orwell's 1984 remains the best analysis of that point. And it might well be true. After the attacks of 9/11, a lot of people discovered something like that, and their political party didn't matter. Second, what might-have-beens make an intriguing claim about a nation's history? With a little push or shove, with an illness here, a death there, a single act of cowardice or courage, a coincidence around the corner, our world could have ended up a whole lot different. If Adolf Hitler had been smarter, maybe most of Europe would have ended up under the Nazis. Without Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the United States might have gone in all sorts of different directions in the 1930s and 40s. In 1936, Lawrence Dennis wrote a book titled The Coming American Fascism. It's not a warning, it's hopeful and optimistic. With some twists and turns in the future, maybe Islamic terrorists will turn significant parts of the world in their preferred directions. Submission, by Michel Houellebecq, is all about that. It's not optimistic, but its arresting narrative arc makes the tale something other than totally implausible. Houellebecq's focus is unusual. Since the 1930s, the question whether it can happen here typically asks about the rise of fascism. But that's a failure of imagination. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Actually, they have. If the United States did not have the history it has had, speculative writers would spin tales that would defy belief, including the enslavement of millions of people in the American South, lynching countless people because of their skin color, decades of racial segregation, denial of the vote to women, until 1920 no less, the internment of more than 100,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast, and also, less bad but not good, the rise of McCarthyism in the 1950s and Nixon's grotesque abuses in the 1970s. This is not a book about Donald Trump, not by any means. But there is no question that many people, including some of the authors here, think that Trump's words and deeds have put the "can it happen here" question on the table. Several of the essays engage his election and his presidency. Some of the authors fear that an election of a left-wing extremist could create its own form of it. But the discussions here reach well beyond President Trump, left-wing extremists, and any other contemporary figure. They are focused on big and enduring questions. For example, is a powerful central government a threat to liberty or a safeguard against it? If a president wants to be a dictator, what steps would he take? Can populism produce authoritarianism? What's the deep state, and should we worry about it? How robust is freedom of speech? Can we rely on our courts? Does the American Constitution solve the problem? What can we learn from history? If some of the chapters are a bit academic, well, that should be taken as a tribute to the seriousness of the topic and to the importance of confronting it with more than a quick glance at politics, law, and history. So, can it happen here? My own summary of this book. Absolutely. It has happened before. It will happen again. To many Americans, something like it is happening now. That's mysterious, I know. Read on. The Dictator's Handbook, U.S. Edition, Eric A. Posner. Tyrannophobia, the fear of the dictator, is as old as the American Republic. The founders worried about being governed by a Caesar or Cromwell, and ever since, as regular as the election cycle, Americans have accused the serving president of harboring dictatorial ambitions. Although none of the 45 men who have occupied the presidency so far have succeeded in their supposed dictatorial goals, the public's tyrannophobia has never been stronger. George W. Bush and Barack Obama, for example, were both routinely compared to Hitler based on their alleged dictatorial behavior and ambition. With the presidency of Donald Trump, tyrannophobia has reached a fever pitch. Even before taking office, Trump was labeled a dictator. The accusations no longer come from the wings, but have taken center stage. Journalists, politicians, academics, and other people with centrist, establishment credentials genuinely fear that Trump will inaugurate authoritarian rule in the United States. Their fears are based on Trump's statements and actions during the campaign. Trump has flouted the norms of American elections and governance at every turn, including calling for the jailing of an opposing candidate, encouraging violence against protesters, endorsing the torture of prisoners, suggesting he might not respect the results of the election, falsely claiming that millions of illegal votes were cast, failing to resolve unprecedented conflicts of interest, or to even disclose his tax returns, and attacking a federal judge based on his ethnicity. And that's, of course, a highly incomplete list. While it's possible that this was all bombast, the stakes are high, and we should take seriously the claim that Trump seeks some level of authoritarian rule, whether or not dictatorship, in its scariest sense, is on the table. Is it possible that he can succeed? Can it happen here? To answer this question, let's assume that Trump does seek to become a dictator in the fullest sense. The problem he faces is that powerful institutions stand between him and the scepter. He would need to subvert these institutions in order to seize the prize. It's worthwhile, if only as an exercise, to imagine how this subversion might work. Tactics. Attack the press. On the campaign trail, Trump threatened to open up libel laws to make it easier for him to sue journalists who defame him. In office, he called the press the enemy of the people. Authoritarian leaders have used libel laws to bully journalists in other countries. In Russia and Turkey, for example, where thousands of libel lawsuits have targeted journalists critical of the regime. But Trump has his work cut out for him in the United States. Trump could try to persuade Congress to enact a new version of the Sedition Act of 1798, which criminalized defamation of the President of the United States. Or he could invoke the Espionage Act of 1917, which criminalized various forms of disloyalty to the government. But the Supreme Court has made it extremely difficult for the government to prosecute journalists and for public figures like Trump to win civil actions against journalists and others who criticize them. How could Trump evade this restriction? A frontal assault on the court's First Amendment jurisprudence would fail for the time being. Justices on the left and right are committed to strong protections for political speech. Trump would need to replace at least five of them, securing the Senate's consent in each case, and it would be hard, perhaps impossible, for him to find even a single qualified mainstream jurist who would supply the vote he needs. But Trump could intimidate the press in other ways. He could order the Justice Department to prosecute journalists who are complicit in leaks of secret documents. While this approach would break with Justice Department precedent, it would be legal. And while it may be difficult to prevail in these prosecutions because of skepticism from judges and hostility from juries, cash-strapped media organizations may be deterred from aggressive investigations of executive branch misconduct. Following the examples of Franklin Roosevelt and Richard Nixon, Trump could also threaten to slow down broadcast license approvals of media that displease him, or interfere with mergers that they seek for business reasons. Again, while courts would not go along, even the threat of dragging out the process might be consequential. Trump might also be able to secure favorable, but narrow, legislation from Congress, and a degree of acquiescence from the courts, if a national emergency takes place and the legislation is tied to the threat in question. Suppose, for example, that a 9/11-style terrorist attack occurs, and Congress passes a law that prohibits anyone from celebrating radical Islam or promoting terrorism. Conceivably, courts could relax First Amendment protections for journalists who criticize Trump's counterterrorism program, though this is highly speculative. In the meantime, Trump has attacked or circumvented the press in lawful, creative ways. He has used Twitter to send messages to the public without the intermediation of press reports, analysis, and editing. He has publicly chastised journalists who are, in his view, excessively critical of him, pursuing a divide-and-conquer strategy by blasting some journalists and media organizations who have criticized him or reported unflattering facts about him while praising others for their fairness. Using tweets, he has directed public attention to fly-by-night media organizations that support his line, giving them traffic from which they profit, and in this way stimulating the production of fake or biased news, and perhaps in the process creating an overall atmosphere of skepticism toward the press as a whole. Perhaps he can persuade a significant portion of the public that anything the press says is wrong. He has even said, the public doesn't believe journalists anymore. Now, maybe I had something to do with that. But whether the strategy succeeds or fails remains to be seen. Trump, following in the footsteps of Obama and other presidents, can also attempt to control the press by restricting the dissemination of information from the government. The Freedom of Information Act and other statutes compel the government to disclose some information, and whistleblower statutes encourage government employees to disclose certain lawful secrets. But Trump can use his executive power to push back against these requirements, for example, by refusing to disclose in the absence of a court order. Finally, Trump can adopt a tactic of authoritarian governments the world over, which enforce generally applicable laws, tax, regulatory, criminal, and so on, more vigorously against journalists, as well as political opponents of all kinds, than against supporters and other people. The executive has nearly unlimited discretion to inflict burdensome investigations on people of its choice, the prospect of which may deter criticism even if prosecutions or convictions do not follow. Attack or evade Congress. Successful dictators who come to power in democracies need to push aside the legislature, which is the major institutional barrier to dictatorial rule. Some dictators shut down the legislature, but most maintain it as a fig leaf or as a subordinate body for airing public concerns, but not for making policy. These dictators bribe or intimidate legislators, or simply disregard them, ruling by diktat through the military or security forces. And some dictators prevail over the legislature simply because they are immensely popular and can call on the public to punish legislative opponents in the polls. None of these approaches are open to Trump, but he has other means to enforce his will. The U.S. president possesses immense powers to act without congressional authorization. He can order the military to conduct operations. He can order the FBI, CIA, and IRS to harass his opponents, as we saw with Nixon. He can also refuse to enforce certain laws, as a series of presidents, including President Obama, refused to enforce the immigration law. And he can order the regulatory agencies to follow priorities that reflect his political interests. All these things can already be done, lawfully, subject to weak and ambiguous limitations. For example, Trump has, on his own, ordered immigration authorities to crack down on illegally present aliens and directed the EPA to ease up on climate regulation. He can impose retaliatory tariffs against China. He can withdraw U.S. forces from the Baltic states and send them to Taiwan. But all these actions require the cooperation of the bureaucracy and the acquiescence of Congress. We will discuss the bureaucracy next. Congress could be roused to action if Trump's actions are too unpopular. Congress retains the power to withdraw delegations on which the president relies, or to pass new statutes that bar his actions. In passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Russia despite Trump's opposition, Congress has done just that. Congress can also use its spending power to block actions that Trump seeks to take, just as it did to prevent Obama from closing Guantanamo. In the end, these conflicts will be resolved either by the courts or by political power. Trump can narrowly interpret new statutes or claim that they violate his constitutional powers, as we saw on repeated occasions during the Bush administration, when Congress tried to restrict its counterterrorism actions. Trump, taking a page from Richard Nixon and Abraham Lincoln, might try to reallocate funds from programs that Congress favors to programs that he favors. Congress could also withdraw cooperation in other areas where Trump needs legal authority, for example, to raise the debt ceiling. This would create new confrontations. Attack the bureaucracy. Presidents rule through the bureaucracy. If the bureaucracy fails to cooperate, then the president cannot be effective. Trump faces not one but multiple bureaucracies, and the different agencies may respond differently to him. The immigration authorities might enthusiastically participate in crackdowns, while the EPA could drag its feet when asked to deregulate. The most important bureaucracy for an aspiring dictator is the military, on which most dictators depend for their power. To control the federal government's vast civil service, Trump needs to appoint loyalists to leadership positions. In most cases, the Senate must consent. Strikingly, Trump has had trouble filling positions. Trump is hampered by the small number of truly loyal supporters who also have significant government experience and hence the ability to control the agencies they are asked to head. Independent political appointees and members of the civil service will almost certainly disobey any orders from Trump, requiring that they violate the law and be put in legal jeopardy. He will also have trouble motivating them to obey even lawful orders that are greatly at variance with precedents, their political preferences, and their agency's historical missions. What can Trump do? In the long term, Trump, if successful, may be able to replace disloyal appointees with loyal appointees, and may be able to attract loyalists to civil service positions. In the short term, he can threaten to undermine agencies that fail to do his bidding, or in any other way pose a threat to his power. Trump did just this, even before he entered office. He lashed out at the intelligence agencies, likening them to the Gestapo, because they reported to the press that Russian meddling helped Trump win the election. This was a high-stakes gambit. It is possible that the intelligence agencies, fearing that they will lose popular support, will think more carefully before crossing Trump. It is also possible that they will work to undermine him. Trump's attack on the intelligence agencies may also serve as a warning to other agencies that might otherwise be inclined to defy him. Once in office, Trump followed this script. He fired FBI Director James Comey for refusing to stop investigations of his aides. He fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates because of her refusal to defend Trump's travel ban. He even publicly chastised his hand-picked Attorney General Jeff Sessions because Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. But these actions backfired. A special counsel was appointed, and thanks to Trump's egregious actions, the special counsel enjoys considerable political support in Congress, even from Republicans. A full-blown dictator needs military support. U.S. military leaders have shown exemplary refusal to meddle in politics or challenge civilian leadership, with the notable but short-lived exception of Douglas MacArthur during the Truman administration. This cuts both ways. Trump can expect loyalty from the military as long as he maintains his position in office and uses the military in lawful ways, even, one suspects, if he engages in unconstitutional behavior, like harassing the press. But it is currently unimaginable that the military would cooperate if Trump called on it to shut down government institutions, as so many dictators in other countries have done. Attack the courts. With a few exceptions, confined to early American history, the U.S. president has given significant respect to the courts. Courts can thwart a dictator's ambitions in many ways. They can protect dissenters from prosecution, civil litigation, and harassment. They can strike down regulations and block executive orders. American judges are protected by life tenure. They benefit from a tradition of independence and are trusted by the public. But there are significant limits on judicial power. The judiciary is largely reactive and can rarely block the executive branch when the president acts swiftly. The courts have, for the most part, refrained from interfering with military orders and foreign policy. They give deference to the president's interpretation of treaties and have permitted the president to withdraw from them, while not interfering with executive agreements with foreign countries that evade the requirement of Senate consent under the Treaty Clause of the Constitution. Moreover, if Trump obtains the cooperation of Congress, he can make significant inroads on judicial power. With legislation, he can strip courts of jurisdiction. He could also follow in the footsteps of Franklin Roosevelt and attempt to increase his support on the Supreme Court by packing it, increasing the number of justices and appointing a majority. But even though Roosevelt was immensely popular when he proposed to pack the court, he failed to convince Congress. The episode seriously damaged his own political standing. Court packing is not a plausible tool for Trump. Trump could order executive officials to disregard judicial orders, putting them at risk of contempt of court. He has not done that so far, but he has publicly criticized judges who have ruled against him, mocking one as a so-called judge, and attacking another group of judges as biased. He actually said, "I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. But courts seem so political." You know what he means. While such personal attacks on the judiciary are almost unprecedented in the United States, it seems unlikely that Trump will intimidate the courts in the short term. Attack the states and local governments. A dictator who sought total control over the country would need to punch through the walls created by the federal system. Consider, for example, the dictator's strategy of enforcing generally applicable laws more harshly against his political opponents than against ordinary people, who might be left alone completely. Most generally applicable laws are enforced by the states and local police, not by the federal government. Even enforcement of federal laws, which overlap with state laws in many ways, requires cooperation with local authorities. Already some cities have announced that they will not cooperate with Trump's plan to round up illegal immigrants. They could even actively shield illegal immigrants from federal authorities. The federal government can impose its will on the states in many ways. By, for example, bestowing or withholding funds, or simply enacting new laws and enforcing them with federal agents. But limits on such control are formidable. The large number of states, their historical independence, the important role that state officials play in the party system, and numerous other factors suggest that they will present significant pockets of resistance to any president who seeks to be a dictator. The only practical way for the federal government to seize states' police powers is through martial law, last accomplished on a wide scale during the Civil War. Barring a catastrophe, this can't happen here. Indeed, Trump's efforts along these lines so far, an attempt to ban funds to so-called sanctuary cities, are modest and have been received skeptically by the courts. Attack the party system. The party system, though not recognized in the Constitution, has emerged as a significant constraint on presidential power. Parties are vast networks in which patronage and other benefits are transferred to the ranks in return for political support for the party's leaders. Most presidents obtain power by working their way up a party hierarchy, in the process being vetted for talent and ideological reliability. Once in power, they continually repay the party by distributing offices and other resources to prominent party members and supporting the party's goals, and in return, receive support from party members who occupy government offices and positions in the press and elsewhere in civil society. By the same token, a president's party can turn on him if he defies it, and the party that is out of power will marshal its own resources to undermine the president by offering benefits to its own members, who, by virtue of their positions in government or in civil society, can subvert the president and bring their own members to power. Trump is unique in modern history as an outsider who came to power by overcoming his party's leadership. And while the Republican Party gave him its support once he won the primary, he must continue to maintain that support, and he is vulnerable if it withdraws that support. Trump also must contend with the Democratic Party, which seeks to undermine him. An ordinary president will rely as much as possible on his own party and occasionally govern with support of moderates of both parties, but such a president is constrained by the party system. What is an aspiring dictator to do? Some dictators and aspiring dictators create new parties outside the established system. Huey Long, for example, if he can be considered an aspiring dictator, or rely on other groups to support them, like an ethnic or regional population, or the military, or the security services. Trump has not moved in this direction. The only likely route to dictatorship involves subordinating the Republican Party establishment to his will, and Trump has not been shy about attacking Republicans who defy him. But it's unclear whether his attacks can bring the Republicans in line. One possible approach is to achieve such a high layer of popularity that party members are afraid to defy him. But Trump is unpopular, and even very popular presidents, like Franklin Roosevelt, have been unable to dominate their parties, except for short periods of time. Another approach is to use patronage to keep the party in line. But Trump, like previous presidents, does not have access to sufficient patronage. There are only so many offices that can be distributed, and these offices are worth only so much. Imaginably, an extremely wealthy president could keep party members in line by using his personal funds, or the funds of wealthy supporters, to legally bribe them with campaign contributions. But even if Trump is as rich as he says he is, he does not have that kind of money, nor does he appear to be willing to spend his own money for this purpose. Attack civil society. The vague term civil society encompasses groups outside government, including the press and parties, which have already been discussed, but other groups play a role as well. Trump already faces significant opposition from the legal profession and from academics. Lawyers will bring lawsuits against virtually any major executive action that smacks of executive overreaching, in many cases funded out of their own pocket, or by law firms, or by public interest groups. Government agencies constantly draw on the expertise of scientists and other researchers who might boycott a Trump administration, or more likely, refuse to provide research and technical support to policies they disapprove of. Public interest groups, religious groups, and other organizations will also organize marches and petitions, publicize executive overreaching, and take other actions to oppose Trump. Although one suspects that many such groups will support him as well, the overall effect is likely to turn the public against Trump if he overreaches, which in turn will embolden Congress, the courts, and the bureaucracy to constrain him. Could a dictator attack civil society? In many countries, they have done just that, by harassing critics and offering rewards to those who give support to the regime. Recep Erdogan has purged Turkish universities as well as the press and bureaucracy. But in the United States, all such efforts would be nearly unprecedented. The closest analogy is the McCarthy era. But in that case, the impetus came from Congress, not the president. And the era was short-lived and ended with Joseph McCarthy's disgrace. Stir up the mob. The most tried and true method of becoming a dictator in the 20th century has been to rely on extra-legal methods, typically involving a mob of supporters who use violence to intimidate opponents, whether they are journalists, bureaucrats, judges, politicians, or ordinary citizens. This was the method of Hitler and Mussolini, which Sinclair Lewis translated into the American setting for his novel, It Can't Happen Here. This method relies on a large group of disaffected people, usually young men, with little to lose, who are fired up by the promises and ideological aspirations of the would-be dictator. In principle, Trump could try to create his own brown shirts by rewarding supporters for their loyalty with offices and other compensation, along with the pardons if they are convicted of crimes. But while Trump has winked at violence on occasion, he has not tried to create a paramilitary to do his bidding. American soil seems especially unpropitious for such a transplant, perhaps because the country has always been too rich, large, and diverse, or the political system has always been effective at addressing the interests of groups that are large enough to pose this kind of threat. Trump has, however, shown considerable imagination in stirring up divisions. His public comments on white nationalists who marched in Charlottesville, on NFL players who kneeled during the national anthem to protest police brutality, and on many other topics, have exacerbated the already deep divisions in the country. It remains unclear whether Trump can take advantage of these divisions in order to consolidate his power, but the possibility cannot be dismissed. Can it happen here? An aspiring dictator would do best by pushing against all these margins rather than try to crush the institutional barriers seriatim. Imagine that Trump, simultaneously, 1. Harasses only the toughest and most critical journalists while encouraging a squid cloud of disinformation that keeps the public in the dark about his mistakes and failures. 2. Defies Congress only in carefully selected cases where his goals are popular and Congress is divided. 3. Harasses agencies that pose a threat to his power, intelligence agencies, while lavishing resources and attention on those that support him, immigration agencies. 4. Disobeys a particularly unpopular judicial order while scorning the integrity of the judge. 5. Divides both parties through skillful distribution of patronage. And 6. Manages to inspire some of his supporters to threaten violence against journalists and government employees who dissent from Trump's rule. Could steady pressure against all these institutions, all at once, cause them to crumble because they cannot rely on each other for support? A point that emerges from the discussion is that the institutions that may block an aspiring dictator depend on one another for mutual support. Journalists can resist a dictator through courageous reporting, but not, or less so, if the dictator's supporters have infiltrated the judiciary, causing it to relax First Amendment protections that keep journalists out of jail, or spare them from paying large fines. The judiciary can block illegal orders, but maybe not if judges fear that Congress will impeach them or strip them of jurisdiction. Congress can defy a dictator, but maybe not if it believes that voters love their leader and will vote against members of Congress who oppose him. Congress may fear even an unpopular dictator if they suspect that the dictator can influence electoral outcomes by manipulating and pressuring the press or controlling the agencies that conduct elections, which, unfortunately for the U.S. president, are mostly state agencies. Or, the point can't be ignored, inviting a foreign power to distribute propaganda. Thus, while a frontal assault by the would-be dictator on a single institution standing alone seems bound to fail, it is possible that a series of more modest actions on multiple fronts, executed patiently over a long period of time, could eventually produce dictatorial power. But, at the time of this writing, this turn of events seems unlikely. Trump took office as one of the most unpopular presidents in history, widely distrusted and even loathed by elected officials, journalists, and the public. And one suspects, judges, and a good portion of the bureaucracy. He has only lost popularity and trust over his first year thanks to his divisive fulminations and reckless actions. With a long record of lies and broken promises, he can hardly expect enthusiastic cooperation, even from people who sympathize with his goals. With critics and civil society nipping at his heels and the public skeptical about his temperament and integrity, Trump is more dependent on the party establishment, the bureaucracy, and other institutions than any president in recent memory. And, as of this writing, he has predictably accomplished very little, with most of his campaign promises unfulfilled. Constitutional Rot, Jack M. Balkin. When you think about politics these days, it's hard to avoid focusing on Donald Trump's remarkable rise to power and his even more remarkable presidency. It's even harder to avoid thinking about the scandals swirling around him day to day. While these are important, they are not the subject of this essay. Instead, I want to look at the big picture. In this picture, Trump is merely a symptom. He is a symptom of a serious problem with our political and constitutional system. Trump outrages and flusters his opponents, so much so that, as we lurch from controversy to controversy, many people wonder whether we are currently in some sort of constitutional crisis. We are not. Rather, we are in a period of constitutional rot. By constitutional rot, I mean decay in the features of our system that maintain it as a healthy republic. Constitutional rot has been going on for some time in the United States, and it has produced our current dysfunctional politics. Constitutional dysfunction isn't the same thing as gridlock. After all, the three branches of government are currently controlled by the same party. Rather, it is a problem of representation. Over time, our political system has become less democratic and less republican. It has become increasingly oligarchical. By democratic, I mean responsive to popular will and popular opinion. By republican, I mean that representatives are devoted to the public good and responsive to the interests of the public as a whole, as opposed to a small group of powerful individuals and groups. When representatives are responsive not to the interests of the public in general, but to a relatively small group of individuals and groups, we have oligarchy. Republics are especially susceptible to constitutional rot. Republics are governments premised on the pursuit of the common good. Representatives are given power for the sole purpose of achieving the public good. The framers of our Constitution understood that republics are fragile things. They are easily corrupted, and over time, they are likely to turn into oligarchies or autocracies. Everybody knows the famous story that when Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of government the Philadelphia Convention had produced, he replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." He wasn't joking. The framers knew that every previous republic in history had eventually fallen apart. At the very end of the convention, Franklin predicted that the new American government is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. When a government becomes oligarchical, leaders spend less and less time working for the public good. Instead, they spend more and more time enriching a small group of important backers that keep them in power. Because the general public feels abandoned by politicians, it gradually loses faith in the political system. This leads to the rise of demagogues, who flatter people with promises that they will make everything right again. In the United States, oligarchy has resulted from the gradual breakdown of the party system that selects candidates and keeps political parties responsive to the public. It has also resulted from changes in how political campaigns are financed, and from long-term changes in the structure of mass media, which have encouraged political distrust, exacerbated polarization, and merged politics with entertainment. Both parties have been affected by these developments, but the problems are especially pronounced in the Republican Party, which styles itself as a populist party but is anything but. A small class of wealthy donors has disproportionate control over the Republican policy agenda. The influence of the donor class over that agenda is the best explanation of developments in Congress. What are the deeper causes of constitutional rot? There are four interlocking features, which we might call the four horsemen of constitutional rot. 1. Political polarization. 2. Loss of trust in government. 3. Increasing economic inequality. And 4. Policy disasters, a term coined by Stephen Griffin to describe important failures in decision-making by our representatives, like the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, and the 2008 financial crisis. Today, one of the most important overarching policy failures is America's inadequate response to globalization. The 2008 financial crisis is a special case of this larger policy failure. A democracy requires a broad-based, stable, and economically secure middle class to create the right incentives for government officials to pursue the public good. If economic inequality gets too pronounced, the wealthiest tend to grab disproportionate political power, and they will use it to further entrench and enrich themselves. A globalized economy threatens a broad-based, stable, and economically secure middle class because it puts serious pressure on social insurance programs and on the economic stability and self-sufficiency of Americans. Political and economic elites have not navigated globalization's changes well. They have taken pretty good care of themselves, but they have not taken care of the whole country. This inadequate response to globalization has hastened constitutional rot. These four horsemen, polarization, loss of trust, economic inequality, and policy disaster, mutually reinforce each other. Political scientists have pointed out that rising economic inequality exacerbates polarization, which in turn helps produce policies that exacerbate inequality. Rising inequality and polarization also encourage loss of trust. Polarization and oligarchy create overconfidence and insulate decision makers from necessary criticism, which makes policy disasters more likely. Policy disasters, in turn, further undermine trust in government, and so on. In an oligarchical system, regardless of its formal legal characteristics, a relatively small number of backers effectively decide who stays in power. In such a system, politicians will have strong incentives to divert resources to the relatively small group of backers who keep them in power. Not surprisingly, the power of government and resources for government are often wasted or diverted from important public goods. Our constitutional system is still formally democratic, but it has become more oligarchical in practice over time. As a result, the United States has wasted a great deal of money on policy disasters. It has shaped the tax code so that most of the benefits of economic growth have gone to the wealthiest Americans. And through unwise tax and fiscal policy, it has diverted a lot of money that could have been used for public services and public goods to the wealthy. Constitutional defenses against constitutional rot. Our Constitution is designed to ward off both oligarchy and demagogues and preserve a republic. For the most part, it has been quite successful in the face of a wide variety of changes and challenges. Some of these features of our constitutional system, however, don't work very well anymore in preventing oligarchical tendencies. Separation of powers between Congress and the President is a good example. Richard Pildes and Daryl Levinson have pointed out that our system is better described as separation of parties rather than separation of powers. When the President and Congress are from the same party, there will be little oversight of the President. The Republican Congress's almost complete disinterest in checking Donald Trump is a particularly worrisome example. Even so, the United States still has many other Republican defenses. We still have an independent judiciary, regular elections, and a free press. Many other countries that have eventually succumbed to autocracy are not so fortunate. Moreover, in the United States, from the founding onward, lawyers have played a crucial role in defending the republic, in staffing an independent judiciary, in promoting rule of law values in the bureaucracy, and in bringing cases to protect constitutional rights and check executive overreach. Once again, many other countries that have become autocratic are not as fortunate as the United States. Propaganda and constitutional rot. One should not underestimate the value of our free press, even as it comes under assault from the Trump administration. Reporters have not been cowed into silence as they have been in other countries. If anything, Trump's shenanigans and his successful manipulation of the press in 2016 have caused the press to think more deeply about its democratic responsibilities. Even so, the power of the press to protect Republican government has been weakened. Part of this is due to economics, and part of it is due to other factors. The American system of freedom of the press was seriously undermined in 2016. It was undermined not by state censorship, but by Trump's very effective hacking of the media. He has proved to be both a master manipulator and a very effective demagogue in the digital era. The system of free press was also undermined by the production of effective propaganda, both from within the United States and from outside it. These two forms of propaganda come from different sources, but they reinforced each other in a perfect storm in 2016. We now have domestic propaganda machines that have thrown their support behind Trump, and now engage in shameless forms of propaganda that would have done Soviet-era apparatchiks proud. The only difference is that instead of propping up communism, they prop up Trump. In addition, Russia and allied groups in Eastern Europe engaged in successful propaganda campaigns during the 2016 election season, designed to enhance Trump's chances and sow discord and confusion in the United States. Propaganda's effects corrode Republican institutions and encourage constitutional rot. Propaganda enhances polarization. It increases distrust of political opponents, as well as those elements of government held by one's political opponents. Propaganda tries to foster controversies that divide the country and enhance mutual distrust and hatred among fellow citizens. It seeks to convert politics into a particularly brutal opposition between virtuous friends and evil enemies who must be stopped at all costs and by any means necessary. Propaganda also undermines the crucial role of deliberation and the search for truth in a democracy. It attempts to put everything in dispute so that nothing can be established as true and everything becomes a matter of personal opinion or partisan belief. Because everything is a matter of opinion, one can assume that anything a political opponent says can be disregarded, and that factual claims contrary to one's own beliefs can also be disregarded. Thus, successful propaganda builds on motivated reasoning and encourages even more motivated reasoning. It undermines shared criteria of reasoning, good faith attempts at deliberation, and mutual accommodation between political opponents in democracies. Moreover, if people stop believing in the truth of what they read, they don't have to think hard about political questions. Instead, they can simply make political decisions based on identity or affiliation with their political allies. Propaganda, in other words, undermines truth to destroy the concept of the public good and to encourage tribalism. As a political system becomes increasingly oligarchical, it also becomes less equal and more polarized and generates greater distrust, both of government in general and of political opponents. People not only lose trust in government, but also in other people who disagree with them. Political opponents appear less as fellow citizens devoted to the common good, and more like internal threats to the nation. Another way of putting it is that in a well-functioning republic, there are friends and potential friends. Potential friends are people you currently disagree with, but might ally with in the future because both of you are devoted to the public good. In a system of constitutional rot, the country falls into something like Carl Schmitt's view that all politics is divided between friends and enemies. From the perspective of a well-functioning republic, Schmitt's friend-enemy distinction is a corruption of politics rather than its essential nature. Trump as a symptom of constitutional rot. Loss of trust in the government and in political opponents eventually produces demagogues who attempt to take advantage of the situation. Demagogues don't spring up unawares. People see them coming from miles away. But by this point, people have lost so much faith in government that they are willing to gamble on a demagogue. They hope that the demagogue can make things right again and restore past glories. Trump is a demagogue. We might even say that he is straight out of central casting for demagogues. Unruly, uncouth, mendacious, dishonest, and cunning. His rise is a symptom of constitutional rot and constitutional dysfunction. Constitutional rot not only allowed Trump to rise to power, it also has given him incentives to increase and exacerbate constitutional rot to stay in power. Many of his actions as president and his media strategy make sense from this perspective. Polarization helps keep Trump in power because it binds his supporters to him. He exacerbates polarization by fomenting outrage and internal division. He also confuses and distracts people, keeping them off balance and in a state of emotional upheaval. Emotional upheaval, in turn, increases fear, and fear increases mutual distrust. Trump doesn't care if his opponents hate him, as long as his base hates and fears his political opponents more. Because his supporters hate and fear his enemies, they are more likely to cling to him, because they are quite certain that his enemies are even worse. Polarization also helps keep most professional politicians in his party from abandoning him. Many Republican politicians do not trust Trump, and many regard him as unqualified. But if Republican politicians turn on Trump, they will be unable to achieve anything during one of the infrequent periods in which they control both Congress and the White House. This will infuriate the base and anger the wealthy group of donors who help keep Republicans in power. Republican politicians who oppose Trump may face primary challenges. Finally, Republican politicians can't be sure that enough of their fellow politicians will follow them if they stick their necks out. In fact, they may provoke a civil war within the Republican Party, in which Trump supporters accuse them of stabbing Trump and the party in the back. Many people think that the sense of upheaval that Trump has created in American politics means that he cannot keep going this way for long, and that his presidency is about to crack apart at any moment. This is a mistake. Polarization and upheaval are good for him. Crisis is his brand. Why Trump has been a populist turncoat. If you understand the relationship between polarization and oligarchy, you will understand a remarkable feature of American politics. Although Trump ran as a populist who promised to protect the working class from the depredations of globalization, as soon as he entered the White House, he reversed course. His cabinet is full of wealthy individuals, and many of his top advisors are from the very financial class that he excoriated in his campaign. Moreover, he has quickly allied himself with the most conservative elements of the Republican Party, and he supported a health care bill that is likely to harm many working-class Americans. The Republican Party in Congress depends on its donor class to stay in power. The central goal of the Republican agenda, therefore, is to deliver benefits to the donor class, either through tax cuts, government expenditures, or deregulation. Congress's repeated attempts to repeal Obamacare are a case in point. The House bill, passed in March 2017, was actually a tax cut disguised as a health care measure. It offered a $600 billion tax cut to the wealthiest Americans, which it paid for by removing some of Obamacare's insurance protections and gradually eliminating its Medicaid expansion. Moreover, by locking in tax cuts in a health care bill, Republicans hoped to make it easier to achieve still other tax reforms that would please their donors. The Senate attempted to pass multiple versions of an Obamacare repeal without success. The basic strategy in these bills was either cutting the taxes supporting Obamacare or cutting its entitlements, particularly Medicaid. Cutting entitlements, in turn, reduces budgetary obligations, thus making it easier to, you guessed it, cut taxes for wealthy donors. From the standpoint of populism, the Republicans' proposed health care bills have been an utter travesty. They withdraw important benefits and protections from working-class Americans to benefit the very wealthiest. Commentators repeatedly pointed out that the bills made no sense if the goal was actually to improve health care. But the bills made perfect sense from the standpoint of oligarchy. Even so-called moderate Republicans depend heavily on the donor class, and therefore they have faced enormous pressures to cave and support the leadership's proposals. In the House, establishment and more moderate Republicans capitulated through a face-saving but ineffectual compromise. They did so not because the Freedom Caucus is so powerful, but because the powerful donors who shaped the party's policy agenda wanted their tax cuts. Because senators knew that their version was likely to be deeply unpopular with the general public, they drafted it in secret, rushing it through to avoid public scrutiny until shortly before votes were taken. After all, as one Senate aide explained, the Republicans aren't stupid. They knew that their bill was toxic, but it pleased their donors and so they were determined to sacrifice any pretense of procedural regularity to achieve their goals. The health care bill is a prime example of constitutional rot. Our nominally Republican system of government has become so infected by oligarchy that the party in power has no